everyone, and welcome back to Small Business Set Aside, where we talk to owners, leaders, influencers, and decision makers in the small business ecosystem of government contracting. I'm Randy Lang, CEO of Firebird AST, and thanks for being with us today. I'm excited today to welcome someone that I've known for almost two decades, but many years went in between when we sort of lost touch. It kind of feels like having a long-lost friend in my living room to chat. So welcome to the pod, Lito Ramadan, President, CEO, and founder of Amanat Consulting. It's great to have you here with me.
Thanks, Randy. Great to be here.
So a little bit of background, Lito. You and I met when we were back in the salt mines of the mega firm Booz Allen back in the early 2000s. Booz Allen is now, I think, a $4 billion professional services company. We were younger then. I had more hair and no kids. Yeah. I remember we were both hungry, ambitious. We burn off steam in the bars along the Arlington Corridor of Clarendon, Courthouse, Ballston. And I don't think any of us had either clue where we'd be 20 years from now. Is that kind of how you remember it?
100%. Yeah, I remember meeting you. It was like a first day event that they had, like a first day training mm-hmm. type of thing. And I remember connecting with you. And yes, I remember those days fondly. Seems like a long time ago.
It was. I remember them fondly. It was. And I remember them fondly. And it's funny how those formative years kind of become a big part of who you are when you grow up professionally or however you call it. But tell me a little bit about this initially, sort of how you went from, you know, big firm. You clearly were a guy, you were polished, you were very comfortable working the politics and the vibe at those big firms, and the journey at a high level, kind of how you got to where you are now. And then I'll ask you a little bit about Amanat when you're done with that.
Sure. Yeah, it's definitely been a journey. I had just, when I met you and started at Booz Allen, I had just finished my MBA from the University of Virginia. So I'd come out, I was all eager and ready to take on anything. And I enjoyed my time at Booz Allen. I was ready and felt comfortable with working the politics of a large organization and the challenges of the consulting problems that we were going to face. But I think I always knew that I was drawn to small business and entrepreneurship, even though I had never done it before, as something that was a little more nimble, have more control of doing things the way you want to, the way that, at least from my perspective, was always how you treat each other, how you treat your clients, how you treat people in general. And about a year into my time at Booz, one of my colleagues at Booz Allen came to me and said, "Hey, I'm going to leave Booz Allen and start a company. You want to come with me?" And, you know, I was 28, didn't really know too much about what he wanted to do. But I was like, "Yeah, let's talk." And I still remember we went to a bar in Arlington and he had written on the back of an envelope a set of five values that he wanted to implement at a company and build a culture with. And I resonated extremely well, or those values resonated extremely well with me. And I frankly think we spoke about the service offerings of what we were going to do for 10% of the time and the type of company we wanted to build and how we wanted to treat people 90% of the time. And I left Booz Allen after a year. We founded Sensio Consulting Group in 2003. And we were successful. We grew the business from scratch. We didn't have a client when we left. We grew it to about 75 people when I left about 10 years later. I'm very focused on bringing private sector procurement practices to the federal government. So we were working with a lot of chief procurement officers and other senior leadership responsible for acquisition, and kind of widened out the service offerings as we grew into broader operational issues. I left Sensio in 2013, difficult decision, but had run pretty hard for about 10 years, learned a lot about myself, learned a lot about how I would eventually want to run a business, took some time off for some personal rejuvenation. I always joke that I look back on 2013, which was the year I took off, and I don't like to think about it too much because that was a lot of fun. I did mm-hmm. a lot of travel. I spent a lot mm-hmm. of time with family, but I learned a lot about myself then. And then I guess most important, I took a couple stops after that. I ran operations at Octo Consulting Group with a friend of mine. Mm-hmm. I was COO at a company, Ocean East, that was kind of similar to Sensio, a small business doing operational consulting. And in 2019, I founded Amanat. So I really decided it was time for me to do something on my own fully, take all of the lessons learned I had over the years, really apply the foundational values that I wanted from a company and kind of do it right and do it from scratch. And we've been very successful. We've been very lucky to bring on some tremendous people. We've been very focused within supply chain strategy within the Department of Defense. The Marine Corps is our biggest client. We're also working with the Navy and really focused on diversifying across DOD now. We're in a really good spot, just trying to find the right people to grow the firm the right way. And it's kind of been my journey to date.
I love the story. So Aminat in many ways is Lito Ramadan's thesis. It's taking all of the lessons, all of the experiences, and now testing this out and taking this to a place where you can prove out all of those concepts. That sounds what it is like to me.
Yeah, that's accurate. And I think a lot of the things that I saw that we did well at Sensio, that were done well at other places that I stopped at, as well as other organizations I've just tracked, I'm trying to implement those along with the things that mean a lot to me.
Yeah. So we follow each other on LinkedIn. And one thing I have admired about your firm and the messaging that I see consistently is about values, is about people. And we share those. We all communicate them differently. But tell me a little bit about the name of the firm, because I did do some research in preparation for the pod. And I won't steal your thunder, but I do love the origin story. Tell me about the name of the company.
Sure. So the name of the company, Aminat, is actually a combination of my parents' names. So my dad's name was Amin, A-M-I-N, and my mom's name is Nadia, N-A-D-I-A. So I truncated her name, but I combined the two. And you know, my real objective in that was twofold. One, I knew that if I named the firm after my parents, I would never sacrifice quality of people, quality of product. Yeah. Then the other thing is, my dad passed away in 2016, but he was, and my mom is, the most generous, kind, caring people who, you know, immigrants from Egypt back in the 60s, built a family from scratch, you know, very successful. And I always felt that I could emulate a lot of the things that they taught me in the business world. And the values that Aminat has put down on paper are all about the things that my parents showed me: kindness, generosity, humility, determination. Those are all things that I felt could be represented in a for-profit business in a way that could build a family and could really build somewhere that people wanted to be and that clients wanted to work with.
Yeah. And as I see some of your corporate messaging, some of your, you know, LinkedIn posts, I see a constant emphasis on people, on family. I see things like FIDIA trivia night, volunteer events, introductions to employees. And so it really comes across as a central part of your corporate identity. And I love it. I'm going to steal your good ideas. I may or may not credit you for it. No, I'm kidding. But I love that. And we're always looking to do similar things at Firebird. So is this all part of the extension and outgrowth from kind of who you are and the family environment you grew up in, your parents? Where does that come from? And do you have folks helping you implement that vision so that it's kind of a shared corporate vision?
Yeah, it's been really nice because it does come from, you know, the name and the values, kind of the things that you see on social media. It's really who we are, which has made it, and it's part of what I'm really enjoying about the Aminat story and what we're creating, is it's been on that side of the things that you're saying you've seen, that's been easy because it's who we are. It's just what we like to do. It's how we like to talk to each other. It's the things we like to do together. So those things, I think they come across genuine and real because they are. We're clearly trying to communicate what we're doing because we think it's a compelling culture for people to join. And that is definitely a strategy, but we're not being uber intentional on, you know, exactly how we're bringing that across, which is nice because we're just representing what we're doing and it resonates with people. So I think that's been really good. And I hired my wife, which some friends of mine did not think was a good idea, but it's worked out well. And she has a background in marketing communication and social media. So it was a really nice fit. Those are all things that I really enjoy as well. So she's definitely helped refine the way we're bringing across the story of who we are to the outside world.
That's great. And it says a lot about the quality of your relationship that you guys can work in that environment and have it work and not become a problem for the company. So that's fantastic that it works. Tell me a little more about your own leadership style, how it's changed or evolved since we were in that young, you know, that that vibe back in Booz Allen. There were a lot of smart people in the room. We both knew that there were a lot of really successful people. And by the way, so many Booz Allen people have gone on to do tremendous things, either at the company or through the alumni network, founding their own companies like your story. How did you develop your own style, and where have you settled on as your own particular leadership style these days?
I've developed my style mostly from experience. You know, I think I had some natural leadership abilities that were pretty raw probably at the time that you and I met. And I think through working with Raj Sharma, who was my co-founder at Sensio, and really seeing the things he did well and trying to realize that there are certain things I was never going to be, you know, like Raj was this creative genius who had a million ideas. And that's not me. I have some good ideas, but I don't have a million. I excel when, you know, I set a clear vision, set some ambitious goals, but have a path towards them. And I realized that as a leader, I performed well and my team performed well when I brought in people who also resonated with that type of style. So one of my mentors, and I know this isn't an uncommon thing to hear, but he always advised me to always try to be the dumbest guy in the room. And, you know, I always want to hire people who are exceedingly bright, but more important than that, have those foundational values around kindness and how we interact with each other. Because I think my leadership style is around being nurturing, being caring, but also setting a clear vision and allowing people to operate in a comfortable environment where they feel safe, they feel like they can challenge each other, and they feel like they understand what their efforts are going to result in. So my leadership has evolved into building that culture, building that environment, and setting a simple but clear vision and ensuring that I have the right people around me to help implement that.
That's such a great testimonial there. And I think what I hear you saying, and by the way, I've adopted a similar style, is the more you get your own ego out of the way and bring smart people in and then use your skills to massage and coax the best ideas and energy and direct it toward a set of targets, that can be a really successful leadership model, as opposed to, I'm the smartest guy in the room, we're going to do what I say, now go do it, right? We've seen that model in a lot of places, and maybe some places it works, but a lot of places it fails.
Yeah, I completely agree. And you think you said it better than I did. And I think that the other aspect of that that I was trying to touch on too was just clarity. I think that one of the things in my past that has impacted me negatively has been when I've worked with leaders, whether it be at my own company or at other companies, where the vision kept changing or there was just a lack of clarity and direction. So I just think it seems simple, but it's, if you have the person at the top of the organization providing changing direction and lack of clarity, it has such an impact on everybody's day-to-day life at the company. So that's just something that, you know, I've also learned from, you know, other leaders I really respect along the way.
Yeah, we all kind of have these mentors, different periods of our life where we learn different things that we can kind of take and apply. That's kind of the fun of the journey. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the knife fight that we're both in every day called government contracting. So talk about the challenges, and this could be for folks out there who are either starting their first GovCon, they may be helping grow one, they may be thinking about it. So the challenges of running and growing a small business in this space, it seems to me more competitive every single year with vehicle consolidation, companies merging, getting acquired, procurement and protest cycles that seem to be longer and longer till you actually see some revenue and return on your BD investments, and large firms always trying to gobble up more market share. What are the challenges you kind of feel like you're facing and dealing with on the daily, weekly, monthly, annual basis right now growing your business?
I think the biggest thing that we face from a challenge perspective is the competition from the large business side that you mentioned. I mean, it's something that as a small business, you just don't have the resources, the relationships, the deep pockets that some of these larges have. And mm-hmm. I know you and I have talked offline about this before. It's just developing those relationships with companies that treat you right and that, you know, aren't saying one thing and doing another. It's just challenging often when you're trying to partner with a mid or a large size company, and you might be dealing with one person who you trust, but that person reports up to somebody else who you don't know, and who has a target that they need to hit, and that they don't necessarily care about the small business that's on the team. So that, I mean, that's something that we run into quite a bit. I think the other challenge for us, because we don't bid on a lot of competitive procurements, the type of work we do, we tend to shape work and attempt to get it direct through our 8A joint venture or through other means of already established contracts while we're growing to the scale where I think we can be successful competing. We're not there yet. We're on our way there. So for us, it's really about identifying the right decision makers within our customer base, which is DoD, getting access to them, and then ensuring that we're doing the right things to move from access and a good meeting to actually closing a deal. And that is also when some of those other sharks in the water sort of come in and obstruct a little bit, which is very frustrating. You know, as a small business who's really can provide a lot of value to the government, and you're kind of raising your hand and jumping up and down, but sometimes those relationships and deep pockets kind of trump that.
Absolutely. For those out there who may not be familiar with the joint venture strategies available to small businesses, and you mentioned yours is an 8A, can you just give a little bit of an overview for some who might be new to the business to understand what a joint venture is in this context and how it could be helpful to a small business?
Yeah, sure. And I'll just give some quick context. So the first company I mentioned, Sensio, we were able to submit to and join the SBA's 8A program. And the 8A program is a program that the SBA provides and approves companies into it for a 9-year stretch, where those companies have the benefit of being able to get work of up to $4.5 million without it being competed. So it's a huge advantage in this space to not have to compete if you're able to create and sell. So when I founded Aminad, one of the things I knew, because of some of the restrictions within the 8A program and the types of firms that they allow in, Aminad did not qualify for them. I'm not part of a minority group that would allow that, nor did I have some of the economic disadvantage side. So I still wanted to ensure that we had the benefit of getting some of these sole source type contracts, because it's such an advantage. So you can create a joint venture with another company that is in one of those programs, whether it be the 8A program or a woman-owned small business or a veteran-owned small business. We formed a joint venture with an 8A company that's run by one of my good friends. And actually, he was at Booz Allen in 2002 when we were. And we created the joint venture. The joint venture gets the 8A status for a period of time. And so we have been selling work through that and benefiting from that. And that's our strategy. We're establishing a number of joint ventures with trusted partners in my network as one of our strategies to get work.
Yeah, smart. And that's definitely something that folks can look into. There's a lot of information out there, or we can, I always make people aware if they want to reach out to someone afterwards, like myself or yourself, to get access if they want to learn more about something like that. So thanks for explaining that. In terms of your goals, you know, it's funny because everyone says you have to have a goal, it has to be a size, it has to be a number. And I don't actually put as much stock in that. I believe in process, and process will lead to outcomes. Do you set, have you written on a secret piece of paper you don't share with anyone, a goal, a size standard, global domination? Like, what is it that you envision for where you want the company to go over the next 2 to 5 years? Let's just pick some bounded period of time.
Yeah, it sounds like you and I are similar in that sense. I don't like setting numeric goals that extend over a long period of time. I mean, we set goals for 1 to 2 years from a size perspective, based upon where we are and where our trajectory is. And one thing that I always say, our main mission is to become a leader in supply chain strategy within DoD. So it's a broad goal. However, one of the reasons we don't put numeric goals around it or even size of company goals around it is because we care so much about the culture and the firm we're building from a values perspective that if we're ever growing too fast and we're starting to lose track, we're starting to see chinks in the armor as far as the type of company we're building, the type of value we're providing, we'll just put the brakes on and fix it. We're not trying to hit a revenue target. We're not trying to hit a certain level of profitability. We clearly have those goals. We're running a business. But what's more important to us is the way we're doing it and what we're building. So we kind of work around that. And my vision and the way I've always thought about growing a small business has been, if you do those things, the growth will come, the profitability will come, if you're focused on ensuring that you're building it the right way.
Yeah, I agree. I definitely think we share that kind of concept in the way we approach goals and growth. So as you look at the market right now, again, you've been in this business a long time. You've been in this business now over 20 years, which sounds like a lot of time. And you've seen it from bigs, mediums, smalls, and now startup. So what are your biggest gripes or frustrations about the environment for small businesses and government contracting? And, you know, what do you think, how can guys like us, what can we do to help address that or fix it? What are the things we need to be advocating for out there to make it a little easier for other small businesses?
Yeah, it's a good question. I guess I don't spend a lot of time thinking about that, so I don't have a great answer offhand. You know, I think that we need, as sort of fellow small businesses, we need to focus on how we can identify and work together more effectively and, you know, form unique partnerships, go to market together in ways that allow us to compete with those larger midsize and large firms. I don't have a specific answer on, you know, structural things that are prohibiting that. Right now, I know that our main focus is at the size we're at now and 3 years into the business is building those trusting relationships with other small to midsize companies so that we'll be able to, you know, work together in a more seamless way, take on larger opportunities, and kind of go head to head with some of the larger firms.
So it sounds like the sort of indirect way is be a good small business corporate citizen, be a part of small business coalitions of other trusted businesses where you can create some strength in numbers. Not that we're ever going to be able to counter a Booz Allen Hamilton, but we might be able to get together on a particular deal, a group of small businesses, and be competitive against something that someone like them might be going after. It would be ludicrous to say Booz Allen is a competitor of Amanat or Firebird, but it's more about how can you create some scale and volume that gives you a little, allows you to punch above your weight a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's easier said than done. You know, I think as you've probably seen through the years, two companies coming together and working together is difficult. It doesn't have to be, but some external forces and internal forces at different companies sometimes make it that way. So finding people that make it easy is not easy, and it takes effort, and kind of building that coalition takes time.
Yeah. And I think I end up being very empathetic and wanting to be supportive of companies that are smaller than us, who are earlier in their life cycle, when I find people that I'm impressed by in terms of the character and quality of who they are, their business acumen. Those become companies that I want to help. I want to bring into a deal. I want to help give them some extra juice as they grow their business, because we all know how hard it is, right? So, and then I hope that gets paid for it somewhere down the line with the business is 10 times my size. It's going to help us along, not because I want a handout, but because we bring something to the table that's valuable, right? So it's sort of like, sure, Hoping that that model pays off over time.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the model that I'm using too. So I'm hoping the same.
So in terms of advice, if you think about, you know, a young Lido 15 years ago who wants to start a firm, or someone out there saying, wow, I'm in a big firm and I see all the infrastructure that's required. I have contracts, security. It can feel a little overwhelming when you look at it and think about doing it on your own. And what would be the advice to those that either want to start their company or have started it and they're working through that first growth curve? Do you have any suggestions on initiatives or areas of business? Maybe that's just based on their experience. And what are the kind of landmines you would tell them to not step on in those early years, things maybe you stepped on that would really imperil the business in those early years?
Yeah, I would say, to your point on what areas of business, I think really focus on what you're good at. There's so many government contractors in this space that try to do a little bit of everything when they're five people, which just doesn't really make sense, because, you know, you're not going to differentiate yourself and you have no real value proposition to your customer. So find something you do well, do it better, and continue to evolve that and build a brand within that service offering. And then you can grow outside of that, start growing some tangential service offerings. The other thing I would advise to the person who's still at a large firm and just thinking about it is, you know, do your due diligence, but at some point, trust in yourself and do it. You know, life's short. Entrepreneurship is fun. It's like nothing else I'd ever experienced in the business world. And as soon as I did it once, I knew I'd never go back, because you just have the ability to build something and to build something that has your imprint on it, to do things the way that you feel like they should be done. And it's a really rewarding process. So at a certain stage, you just have to go. And then you really need to build that mentality into how you're running your business too, because that would be my other word of advice is, don't bring complexity to your small business when you're small. Simplify your decision-making. One of the benefits of being a small business is you don't have the bureaucracy. You don't have all of the layers of decision-making. If you want to roll something new out or hire somebody, just do it. Do it fast. That's your advantage. Don't, you know, create a 9-step decision-making process and talk about it for 3 months. The last one would be stay true. For me, at least, this was very relevant for me, was staying true to your values, those foundational things that mean a lot to you, and make them, when I thought about the specific values for Amanad, it was a big deal to me to say, you know, are these words I'm going to live by in every major decision we make as a firm? If they're not, just take it off your values. And you can still have it as something that means something to you, but make those values important and allow them to drive your decision-making and the way you operate your business. And when you do that, and if those values are truly part of you, then it makes running the business easy.
Yeah, that's a great last point. And I want to circle back to your point about complexity. And I don't mean to pick on Booz, because it's part of my origin story and yours, and it's an amazingly successful company. But I'll put this out there, the performance reviews, which I'm sure you remember. So at some point, the performance review had gotten to some god-awful number of pages, like 20 pages, 15 pages, you know, and having to actually do one was just as tough as having to actually do your own review. And it just got to the point where the words just didn't mean much anymore, or decisions had been preordained. So one of the things we've taken is make our performance review, they need to be meaningful, but they also need to be much more streamlined, right? Give me the high level, what am I doing well? What would you like me to see do differently? And, you know, what should I be working on in terms of my long-term growth? And it was an example where I thought it had just gotten so over-engineered. And everyone at Booz Allen knew it, but just it was, they've always done it that way and it never changed. Right. And maybe it has today, but it hadn't back as of a few years ago.
I don't think it has. And I just from what people I talk to, and I think at a lot of, you know, large, mid-sized, even small firms, it's that way. I mean, one of our corporate values is simplicity, and we try to bring it into all of our operational aspects of the business and how we're running the company, and also, frankly, how we deliver our services. You know, we solve complex problems for our clients. But when we communicate them out, we try to simplify to ensure that it's clear, it's direct, it's actionable. And so we do what we can to bring simplicity into all parts of the business.
Simplicity and agility, right? So the other advantage we have as smalls is, I'm sure you will take a call from your customer anytime, as would I, and its ability to quickly react, be nimble, respond to a situation, come up with a solution, fix a problem, to do it quickly. And it is an inherent advantage we have, because there's not three or four layers that have to review and agree. So that is an advantage.
Yeah, it totally is. And I think about the launching of Sensio back in 2004, when I was mentioning us bringing private sector acquisition practices into the federal government. OMB had just released a memo mandating federal agencies to do strategic sourcing, to bring some of these private sector practices. And we were so ready to jump on it when that memo came out that, you know, we created these binders, we sent them to a variety of senior stakeholders. We were running out there and creating an organization that could quickly respond to that. And if we were at a Booz Allen or somewhere else, the layers that you'd have to go through to create a new service offering to, you know, ensure that you we're reaching out to this client the right way. And then this client is owned by this partner, so you can't actually talk to them.
Yes.
So that agility and the ability to be nimble in that specific example, frankly, allowed us to launch a firm. I mean, that was where we started to win some clients, and it's because we were quick.
Yeah.
And we took advantage of that.
it's something we can lean into. Being small has disadvantages, but that's one of those things we can lean into and be more maneuverable than the big firms. So it's something that we should take advantage of.
For sure.
Okay. So kind of getting down toward the end, I want to talk a little bit about kind of balance. You know, work-life balance has been a topic for 20 years. It became an even bigger topic during COVID when people started working remotely. You and I know this business can be a grind. There's always more deals to find. There's another proposal to write. There's another publication to read, another employee to reach out to. And my question to you is, as you think about balance and not burning out, how do you manage it, manage that? I know you recently, I hope you don't mind sharing with our listeners, you just had a son, and I'm sure he doesn't care at all about RFPs, RFIs, and pricing volumes. And knowing you, I'm sure making time for your family is a big priority for you and part of who you are. So how do you balance the need to constantly feed the business and feed Lito's family needs and other need to not burn out and things like that?
Yeah. So you're right. Liam, my 7-week-old son, I try to tell him about when a proposal is dropping, but he just cries and then goes to the bathroom and then sleeps. So he has the same reaction to pretty much everything I tell him. But I feel like for me with work-life balance, I approach it. We've built the business around ensuring we're not burning our people out. That's a big aspect of us. We want people to be comfortable in their lives and work hard, but not have it impact their personal lives and their family lives. So I think if everybody's on the same page with that, it kind of builds on itself. I mean, we're not, when we make decisions on things we're going after, like if, you know, we have 3 RFPs come out, right? And you know, one of them looks like a perfect fit. 2 of them are, you know, potentially a stretch, but, you know, maybe we take a swing at it. I'm not going to take a swing at one of them if our capture group is, you know, a little bit overloaded. It's okay. You know, we're okay with growing at a pace that allows us to live our lives in a way that, you know, is rewarding and is not detracting from our families. So I think it's, again, I don't really have a formula for it or specifics. I think it's more the decisions we make, because that aspect of work-life balance is kind of rooted in the company and who we are. We naturally are making decisions that don't put our people in situations where they have to work 80 hours, or if they are, we're paying very, you know, keen attention to it and trying to address it, whether it's by, you know, hiring someone new or bringing on a contractor, or just, you know, somehow alleviating that stress.
Yeah. So you kind of try to build the kind of managing that into your culture, keeping an eye on people. Maybe there's a period where they're going to have to work hard, but you know, we all know that's not sustainable. It's sustainable for short bursts. People are not robots. We can't work like that. So it sounds like that's kind of built into your people culture as well, which I think is very smart. So, well, hey, Lito, it is always great to catch up with you. I know I want to catch up with you more offline. Thank you so much for coming on today. I know you've been a tremendous success in this business in multiple different iterations. I've always admired, you know, the way you handle yourself. I count you as a friend and colleague. So I really appreciate you coming on. I know people are going to listen and learn and watch from your experiences, and I believe it'll be a benefit for folks learning about that. So thanks so much for coming on the podcast today.
Thank you, Randy. Feel the same about you. And I look forward to us continuing communicating both professionally and personally.